Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/news-ad-free. That's amazon.com/news-ad-free to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hello and welcome to Press Gazette's Journalism Matters podcast. I'm Freddie Mayhew.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
News editor at Press Gazette. And today I'm joined by Rachel Oldroyd, who is the managing editor of the Bureau of Investigative Journalism. Thank you for joining me, Rachel.
You're welcome.
Now, I just want to start us off. I was at the Bureau's debate the other night with famous Harry Evans, and you mentioned, well, you sort of riffed off President Trump's campaign quote, and you said, we need to make journalism great again. But I just wondered if you could expand on that and just tell me what you meant by that.
So my point, or the statement was made in relation to all the criticism that we as an industry are getting. And, you know, this isn't just from Trump. It's sort of really kicked off under Trump. We've had, you know, fake news, the failing media, the phony media, and as of a couple of weeks ago, we're now the enemies of the people. But I don't think it's just coming from Trump, to be honest. You know, in this country, post-Leveson, post-phone hacking, the view of the media in the general public's eyes is really quite low. And we need to raise our profile. We need to add value to journalism again. We need to tell people how important journalism is and what society would look like without journalism. You only really need to look across at the States where local press just no longer exists, where you've got two big papers and the news agenda is dominated by Fox News. You know, if we're not careful, we're going to be in a similar position in the UK. Fortunately, we have the BBC, but, you know, the press in this country is doing great, great journalism, but, you know, we are an industry in crisis, and I think we've got to change our message from the negative to the positive and start telling people what a great thing journalism is and that it is has an intrinsic value to democracy and a functioning society.
And I don't expect you necessarily to have an immediate solution to that, but what do you think? What do you think we can do? I mean, to sort of get.
Well, I think we start with changing the language.
Right.
You know, we as an industry are absolutely brilliant at telling everyone how, what an awful time we're having and how the media's in crisis and how we're failing and, you know, the loss of our revenues. We need to change the whole language and whole debate and start talking about the positives and what journalism does for society and how a free, strong press is super important for society, and therefore we attach a value to what we do. And I think that if we start changing the language and start changing the debate and emphasising the importance of our industry, I think we will start changing public concept and public view of it. And I think we are starting to see a change of that. You know, the argument actually between IPSO and Impress is actually having a positive effect, because both bodies are starting to increasingly talk about the importance of the free press. Yeah. And that's, you know, I think that is really helping. But we as an industry, we have to do the same.
And I think you mentioned at the debate just sort of getting more journalists generally, having more journalists mm-hmm. to do more journalism, because obviously a lot with all the sort of alternative facts and everything going on, there's a lot more time and resources being pulled on just trying to establish what is true. Can we get more journalists as we are?
Well, look, you know, it's something I feel completely passionate about, how the number of journalists in our industry has, you know, really, really reduced in my time as a journalist. I've been in the profession for 20 years and I've just seen the number of journalists in newsrooms just fall through the floor, really, quite honestly. And the figures in the US, it's journalists, number of journalists working has halved in the past 10 years. You know, the Press Gazette has reported on this quite a lot about the drop in number of journalists in the UK. And obviously, you know, you do have to take into account that lots of people who have gone into journalism have been moved into the online and they've moved into that world. But, you know, the type of journalism that you do on, if you're working on the online sections of newspapers, is not the type of journalism that people used to do on the news desks of our national press. We need more journalists. I don't have a solution, because obviously revenues are going down quite dramatically, but we do need, as a society, to find a way to pay for more journalists.
And to touch on it briefly, I think fake news is sort of, we're almost a bit fed up with it, investigators, with so much going on, and so Harry Evans said the other night, you know, stop using the term. But just to take away, what are your sort of thoughts on that? Is that a real threat in the UK to journalism, do you think?
Well, first, to emphasise what Sir Harry Evans said about let's change the term, let's not use, let's talk about lies, let's talk about made-up stories. And this goes back to my earlier point about let's change the language. Let's stop talking about fake news. There's no such thing as fake news. News is truth, it's fact. And if we use the Trump language, then we shoot ourselves in the foot. Is it a problem in the UK? Well, I think it is a problem because we operate in a global world. Everybody gets their news in a different way these days. You know, some people get it in the old traditional way, some people get it through their social feeds, and their social feeds operate in a global environment. So, you know, I think it's as hard in the UK for certainly the generation under 25 to recognise fact from fiction as it is for you know, sort of a young person in America.
Yeah, I suppose if we sort of riff on that and if we can just talk about the Bureau as well and the McAlpine mm-hmm. sort of affair. Sure. Obviously, I think it was your predecessor, wasn't it?
Two predecessors.
Certainly, Ian Overton stood mm-hmm. down from the Bureau. This was in 2012, after basically wrongly implying that Lord McAlpine was the political figure who might be a paedophile. And there's been a big fallout from that, obviously, and it appeared to be based on the testimony of one man who since turned out had wrongly identified Lord McAlpine. That's obviously slightly old news now, but do you think you were fairly treated on that, Bureau?
I think there was a bit of a lack of understanding about what actually went on. It wasn't a Bureau story, it wasn't a Bureau journalism. It was a Bureau journalist who had previously worked for the BBC for a long time before coming to us, and he was seconded to Newsnight for a week to redo a story that he had already done for the BBC. And the Bureau made mistakes. We didn't make mistakes in our journalism because we didn't contribute to it journalistically, but, you know, we made mistakes, and the people responsible for making those mistakes left the organisation very quickly. And I would say that the organisation, obviously we went through, you know, a difficult time, but it did mean that we looked at all our processes. It meant that We added things to our processes to ensure things like this, things like that didn't happen again as far as possible. All organisations make mistakes, and I don't see Ian Katz being asked about the issue very often. It often does still come up in conversation with the Bureau. It is 5 years old now. We are a different organisation without the people involved, and, papers, journalists do make mistakes.
So lessons learned from that are you've changed processes, basically?
Well, we haven't changed processes. I think we had very robust processes in place right from the beginning. Running a small organisation focused on investigative journalism, wanting to take on powerful people meant we had to have very robust processes in place. And the organisation was set up and run by people who had worked in the media for a long time. We have a lot of experience in the Bureau. We might be a small team, but between us we have a lot of experience. So it wasn't a case of changing processes, it was a case of re-looking at our processes, just as the BBC did, and identifying where there were any weaknesses or where there were any holes and making sure we plugged that and trying to ensure that we learnt lessons. But I have to emphasise, we have really strong journalistic processes at the Bureau and always have. We do fact checking to the level that American journalists do. We are really cautious about, cautious is the wrong word, but we are really careful about what we put out. We got caught up in a story. We were involved in it to a certain extent, and we did what was necessary to move on from it. And we're still here. And I think that is, we're still here and we're strong and we're growing. And, we had definitely got over it.
When did you see the reputation start to recover? It must have taken a hit.
Yeah, of course we took a hit. And, the fact that we're still talking about it now, 5 years on, shows that it is still part of our history. In all honesty, I think it probably took us a couple of years to get over it. But we had an acting editor running the organisation post the event who was with us for 18 months, by which point the board felt that we had moved the organisation on and that we had regained our reputation. And from that point we started to grow again.
Switching tack slightly, what sort of drew you to working at the Bureau? Because did you join 2010, is that right?
Yeah, I joined shortly after it launched.
I
became deputy editor 6 months after it officially launched. So what drew me? Well, I became a journalist because effectively I wanted to change the world. I believe in public interest journalism. I believe that journalism really can make a difference to the world. I had been at the Mail on Sunday prior to joining the Bureau for 13 years. Much of the work that I had done at the Mail on Sunday was sort of investigative or reportage or very public interest type journalism. I wanted to change personally, and I was really inspired by what the Bureau was trying to do when it was launched. I really wanted to work for the organisation.
And what's it been like? I mean, 5 years since, what's it?
It is very different working for a small organisation than working for a big organisation like the Mail on Sunday. Very different working for an organisation that is driven by impact as opposed to readers and reach and all journalists have the same value system, but our organisation is really driven by impact and wanting change as opposed to a commercial organisation which, journalism aside, is driven by profits and a need to be a good functioning commercial organisation.
Which leads us neatly on to how you're sort of funded and how you run. So, but first of all, how many editorial staff do you have, roughly?
We have just hired 3 new journalists for a new project that we've got up and running. So we've got 15 members of staff currently, not all 100% full-time. We're sort of a reasonable sized team now.
And it's not-for-profit organisation, but how does sort of the funding come about? Is there a commercial arm that's sort of selling your stuff out there, or how are you funded?
So we're a not-for-profit organisation totally funded by philanthropy. We have 9 funders currently, mostly foundation funding. We are in the process of expanding our funding, both in terms of the amount, but also the numbers of funders. We're really trying to reach out to individuals now, build up individual giving as well as foundation giving. We don't have a commercial arm, and we do sometimes make money from organisations that we work with, and that obviously goes back into our core funding and it's used for our journalism. But we work collaboratively with publishing partners because we do feel that we need their reach and we need their readers, and we sometimes need their journalists to help on our stories. So particularly beat journalists, you know, for this, they've got a specialist journalist, it's really helpful sometimes. So we tend to work more collaboratively than on a commercial arrangement.
So is that, but in that situation, sort of a tie-up, is it sort of situation, or would that be something where you are being, you're being paid to do that?
No, so it's an unpaid collaborative relationship. So we don't act as freelance journalists. We act as an organisation driven by, driven by impact. So when we are looking at an area of investigation, and when we're getting close to publication, we work out how we can make our work have the most impact, and that includes which is the best publishing partner to publish with.
So it's pure. So it's purely funded through
philanthropic giving. Yeah.
So donations, basically.
Donations. Yeah. I mean, we're modelled on American or similar American organisations. I've spent quite a lot of time in the States in the past couple of years, visiting organisations like ProPublica and the Centre for Investigative Reporting, which are really successful, growing organisations in the US. There's 150 not-for-profit journalistic organisations in the US of varying size. And we've looked at what they do and how they do it, and we've tried to introduce the model into the UK.
Is there no worry that the funding will dry up at some point?
Well, you know, I mean, this is a question that I get asked all the time, like, how sustainable is it? And, you know, how long-term is it? Well, you know, I could ask the same question of traditional media these days. You know, how sustainable is print journalism? We live in very uncertain times. It's the media industry. You know, we live in a very fast-changing world. I can't look into a crystal ball and say we're going to be around in 10 years' time. I do, in my gut, feel that we will be around in 10 years' time. And actually, if you look at how much the whole not-for-profit sector in journalism is growing in the US, and how it is growing out beyond the US now as well, I do think there is a really strong sector here that is emerging.
And are you making, as an organisation, any attempt to find sort of a model where you can, you know, earn income and revenue? Because if we look, I'm just thinking, for example, Exaro, which obviously closed last year, and Mark Watts, the editor, told me about sort of fumbled opportunities, what he said, to perhaps make selling data work or make tie-ups work. I mean, is that anything that you've looked at?
It's not something that we've ruled out, for sure. It's not something that we're actively pursuing at the moment, but we are going through a strategic review process, where we will come up with a new strategic plan for the organisation, and you know, that might be part of it. I don't know at this stage. I do think it's important to recognise that the ethos of our organisation is to use journalism to hold the powerful to account, and you know, that's our mission. And the best way to pursue that mission is to focus on how we can employ the most journalists. And not focus on how do we get commercial income from this or that or the other. I mean, you know, it is a slightly different focus. We run very similar to an NGO. NGOs work on philanthropic funding, and I don't think they're ever questioned about, is your funding going to dry out?
Yeah.
I think it's more, how far can we grow, actually? And I do think there's a huge opportunity. I think that particularly post-Brexit and post-Trump, the public is starting to understand how important journalism is, and they're starting to see that, and understand that journalists and journalism have been cut, and that they will have to pay for it. I mean, ProPublica has seen over $1 million pour into its coffers since the election of Trump. That's in 2.5 months. We're not in the same position in the UK because we haven't got Trump, but I do think lots of people in the UK are really, really concerned about how this new sort of protectionism and new political sort of environment on a global scale is impacting society. And journalism does really play an important part in trying to explain that.
And I suppose the one thing I'd say is your added risk with the kind of journalism that you're doing in particular is those legal threats.
Yeah.
Have you fielded many of those in the sort of 5 years being there, or are there any that have sort of troubled the organisation?
So we have a retained lawyer, and we work, you know, all the time on every story with our lawyers. We bring in lawyers from quite an early stage often in our journalism. Our right to reply process is such that, you know, we take a very broadcast approach to right to reply, actually. So, you know, we tend to give people a long time to reply. We will put, you know, it might not necessarily just be one right to reply, it could be several. And one of the other reasons for working collaboratively with big publishing platforms is you do bring their weight, you know, to bear on subjects that, you know, on areas where there is somebody or an organisation that could be quite forceful.
So there's some security in the collaboration.
I think the collaboration, I mean, Richard Sandbrook was talking about this at the event, actually, about, you know, small organisations operating in an environment of investigative journalism, which by its very nature, you're going to be investigating figures and organisations that have money and can sue you. So, you know, it doesn't mitigate all risk by working with publishing partners, but it, you know, it helps.
And just talk about stories. I mean, how do they normally come into you then? How does that normally arrive at the bureau's desk? Or is it normally people phoning in anonymously, or are you mining data? Or what sort of, how do you normally?
So, you know, like any newsroom, to be honest, we have all our journalists are looking at areas to work on all the time. They have their own contacts, they come up with their own story ideas. We occasionally work with freelancers who come in with a great story that they know is going to take a long time and are looking for extra resource to help them do that. And usually it's resource in terms of, well, obviously in terms of money, but also in terms of a team that can help them work on it. And we have whistleblowers that come to us with stories. I think one of the key, in terms of how we decide on our stories, is it ambitious enough? Is it a big enough project? Is it something where we can bring something, an added asset to the picture? So, you know, is there data? We do lots of data stories. Is there documents that we can get? Is there a whistleblower that we can work with?
And presumably sometimes these stories take a long time to stand up, sort of up to months.
Yeah, I mean, we really go for the stories that, you know, do take a long time to work on. We're not a publishing platform. We do have a website, but we're not a publishing platform. So we're not looking for stories every 5 minutes. Not, you know, can we turn this around in a week? Do we, you know, how long is it going to take? That's never really a question. It's, we do project plans at the beginning of our stories, work out what we need to get, where we're going with the story, and we are as ambitious as we can be on every single story. Some stories will take 6 months, 9 months before we get them out.
I was going to say, what's the longest it's ever taken to sort of get a story published for you guys?
Well, I mean, that's a sort of asking the wrong question, really. How, you know, because it's not what's the longest it takes, it's, you know, how much time is required. So one of the investigations we did that has taken the most time to get to the end result was a big piece of work that we undertook in the first year, which was looking at European structural funds, which took a team of 6 people 9 months, mainly because the data didn't exist at European level, and we had to go to every single member state and often down to mayoral offices, sometimes down to fax machines, to actually pull the data together into a massive big database. And then that took in itself 4 months, and then we had to mine it for stories, and then we had to go and report on those stories. So, you know, it was a process. Our drones project has been running 5 years, but obviously we publish quite a lot on that. More recently, stories that we have done, we ran a story last year with the Sunday Times looking at a contract that Bell Pottinger had with the Department of Defence in the US. And that was a 6-month project because that came out of a big, big data examination and exploration of Department of Defence spending in the US. And then we discovered this contract. You know, the process of building that database took 3 months. Then we had to analyse it for stories, then we had to work out which stories we were going to pursue, and then you get to the journalism bit. And that took, you know, a couple of months to track down somebody who prepared to talk about it, then persuading that person you know, that we could be trusted and building up relationships, and then doing the reporting from America, the reporting from Iraq. You know, it takes time.
And does that rank among some of the stories you're sort of most proud of doing? Is there any that stick in the mind?
You know, I'm proud of pretty much everything we put out. I mean, genuinely, because we're very focused. So we're not a news desk that is about filling space. We are a news operation that is about coming up with stories that serve a public interest. So, you know, every story, even if it is a small story that took us a month, it's doing a job that I believe in.
Now, last February, the Bureau was awarded, was it £500,000 for it was a 3-year local journalism project, wasn't it,
mm-hmm.
from Google?
Mm-hmm.
Can you just sort of briefly outline that for me and just say if there's any sort of stories coming out of it?
Yeah, sure. So, we got, it was €660,000 from Google to launch a project which is focused on compiling databases that will provide public interest stories at a local level. So most of the work that we have done up to now have been very national focused. We've focused on national issues, or, you know, we've published the national picture of data. And actually, I feel that one of the biggest democratic deficits that is happening in this country currently is actually at a local level. And there is this huge amount of data that is becoming available increasingly as the government opens itself up. And, it is still difficult, but government data is becoming more and more available, and so we're looking at applying our investigative skills with big data skills to create quite difficult databases. This is not, you know, sort of reactive journalism. It really is building the databases that we will then offer to a network of local journalists.
And that's the data lab, isn't it?
That's the data lab, yeah. So, you know, we have now recruited the team. We're on the verge of making an announcement about that in a couple of weeks. And we will be seeing stories coming out of that in the next few months.
And one thing I did want to talk to you about was the... there was a report published just the other week about protecting whistleblowers and mm-hmm. sources from Sawyer. And there's been lots in the news about the risk to whistleblowers and sources from changes to the law. The proposals of amendments to the Official Secrets Act, which has been dubbed the Espionage Act, and the Digital Economy Bill, and all sorts of things going through that present a risk to public interest journalism. And I just wondered, first of all, how do you as an organisation go about sort of trying to protect sources and whistleblowers?
Well, we take it very, very seriously. I mean, very seriously. You know, it's very hard these days to be able to completely promise total anonymity. You know, we've seen issues in the US where, you know, journalists have met sources in parks and they've still been able to be tracked because the intelligence services have looked at their locations from their phones. So, you know, it is really difficult, but you know, any responsible journalist has to take the protection of their source seriously, and we really, really do. I think that there is a huge attack or potential attack going on at the moment on journalism. I think Section 40 is really, really problematic. I mean, probably problematic. It could have a huge impact on an organisation like the Bureau. I think the changes to the Official Secrets Act are just, you know, they come from a different age. it's almost like we're going backwards. The use of REPA, you know, the freedom of the press is under as much attack in this country as it is in the US. It's just less upfront. It's not coming from the mouth of our Prime Minister, but it is coming from our government.
And is the Bureau regulated? Are you with IPSO?
We haven't signed a regulator yet. We've taken the sort of the Guardian and independent and FT approach. We're waiting to see.
If Section 40 did come in, that would be...
It would be a huge deal for us. Hugely problematic for us. I mean, we're a small organisation, you know. The cost that we could incur could basically bring the organisation to its knees.
Yeah.
And it would force us to sign up to one of the bodies, whichever body the government decides to, well, you know, obviously impress at the moment, but whether it will accept it so is you know, it's being debated currently. So
what's your view on impress? Is that state regulation effectively for the Bureau?
Look, I am, you know, as an organisation, we haven't taken a line as yet, because I think there's so much debate and discussion going on, and I think we're in early stages, to be really honest.
And presumably a lot of your stories at the Bureau are coming from whistleblowers and anonymous sources. Mm. Is there any idea on sort of percentage of stories? Is that sort of the mainstay? Or?
No, I don't think it's the mainstay. We often use whistleblowers, but we find the whistleblowers, if you know what I mean. So, you know, a lot of our stories will work with insiders, will work with people that we've tracked down who used to work at organisations that we were reporting on, or government bodies that we were reporting on. You know, we try to talk to as many people as possible. So do we get leaks? Do most of our stories come from leaks? Again, sometimes we get leaks in the process of our reporting.
But yeah. It's fundamental to the way you work.
Yeah, I mean, we get information all the time. Mm. I mean, that is investigative journalism. Good investigative journalism discovers information and is given information through good reporting, through talking to lots of people.
And sort of everyone is saying at the moment, but I wanted to hear from you. Why do you think public interest journalism is more vital now than it ever has been?
I don't think it is more vital now than it ever has been. Public interest journalism has always been vital. But I do think that journalism is more vital now than ever before, because we are moving into a world where, you know, lying from our elected officials is becoming acceptable. What is going on in the US is quite unbelievable. I mean, politicians have always lied to us. There's always been propaganda. There's always been dodgy dossiers. But, you know, it's happening at a level of audacity that I've just, you know, it's just completely new. Because we're seeing lies, then we're seeing challenges, and then we're seeing denials that was ever said. So there's obviously a lot of time and resource and journalism required to constantly fact-check what is coming out of our administrations. And it's in the UK as well. I mean, obviously not completely different scale, but nonetheless, we operate in the global world, and, you know, we're having to fact-check Trump as much as US journalists. So, you know, I think there's so much journalism that is going into that element at the moment that it's distracting from all the other really important things that we should be covering. You know, what is happening in our social services? What is happening in the NHS? What is happening in our societies? Why is there so much pain being felt in this country and in the US and in Europe? What's going to happen in Brexit? There's so many big, really, really, really complex issues, actually, that need reporting on. And I just don't think we have enough journalists to cover it.
Yeah, certainly Trump and his fake news show is blinding, isn't it?
It really is. I was in the US just before Christmas and had a conversation with a very senior political reporter at the Washington Post, who's saying, you know, the problem is it's not just the political desk that is reporting on the administration now. We're having to pull in, and we are going to have to increasingly pull in, all our specialist reporters, because if something is said about the transport, for example, we need the transport expert to tell us whether what they're saying is true.
Yeah.
And how do you report on Trump?
Yeah.
It's a big question that American journalists are asking themselves. How do we report on this administration?
Yeah.
And, you know, it's the same in this country. How do we report on Brexit when actually there has been not very much coverage of Europe, because as a society we've not really been that interested in Europe. It's very complicated. And suddenly we're having to get our heads around these really complex laws and mechanisms and how Europe works and how we can pull out. And, you know, the Times has just announced a massive team on Brexit, and I think that's brilliant. I think, you know, every single newspaper should be putting big, big teams on Brexit. But if they have limited resources, so, you know, if they're putting big teams on Brexit, which is really important, what bits are they not covering?
Yeah. And just as a final note, any tips from you for anyone listening who might be an aspiring investigative journalist?
Well, I always tell, you know, sort of young student journalists that one of the biggest things that they can do is make sure they're skilled up in sort of computational skills, because this is a whole new growing area, how we can use tech skills to help investigate. That's not just about data, but it's also about using tech skills to do really advanced searching, to explore who is behind all these fake news sites, for example. Then their skills that a new generation of journalists will need, and they are skills that are in huge demand, and they're skills that, you know, people from my generation just really, really, really struggle with. And, you know, to bring those skills into investigative journalism and then learn the skills of investigative journalism will make somebody a very powerful reporter.
Rachel Aldroyd, thank you for joining me.
Okay. Thank you.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey, everyone. Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.